Well, thank you, Mr. Burrow. Good afternoon, everyone. Trust all of you are enjoying this beautiful weather out here, this wonderful Sabbath day. It sure is a blessing to have it. We'll welcome any of those on the webcast as well, and any visitors we have, we are certainly glad to have you today. About a year or so ago, I was caught up in somewhat of a humorous piece of entertainment, which was the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial. I don't know if many of you remember that or not, but it was pretty popular when it was going on. Everyone was so enthralled in it, and some were Team Heard, some Depp, and so forth. But I remember one exchange in particular that kind of, I don't know if this happens in courtrooms all the time, I assume it does, but it really painted a picture for me. Mrs. Heard's attorney was questioning a professional witness for Mr. Depp. And I remember her asking the questions in such a way that it was somewhat kind of disturbing, because you could tell that the truth was not what they were actually seeking. What the attorney was trying to do was make the jury and the parties that be doubt the credibility of the witness. That's really what they were trying to do. She would ask yes or no questions in such a way where the person would kind of have to answer yes or no, but was not really given a way to explain why how they come to their answer. And as a matter of fact, one time their professional witness actually asked, "Can I explain why I'm saying no?" And the attorney said, "No, you cannot." So it was very obvious that truth was not what they were seeking, but rather doubt was the case that they were building. You know, I thought to myself, us, you know, in the Christian walk, doubt is probably one of the chief tools that Satan uses against us. You know, and if we kind of use that courtroom scenario where you've got faith on one side and doubt on the other, doubt is always sitting there just screaming its case. It's always trying to make you doubt where you are going in your walk with God. You know, I was asking myself during this exchange, I said, man, what if the other attorney wasn't able to cross-examine this witness? I'm like, man, you know, that attorney did such a good job at destroying the credibility of the professional witness that there would have been no credibility. And you couldn't have believed what she was trying to say against Mrs. Heard. It's just, you know, if there was no rebuttal, they wouldn't have stood a chance. So for today's sake, let's try to think about a courtroom scenario, and let's put faith on one side and doubt on the other. And let's try to think about how those two are constantly in battle with one another. You know, doubt is always present to some degree. And it's always, most of the time, it's accompanied by some overwhelming evidence. As I think back on life, and I think many of us could do the same thing, when you're looking back at tests or trials, you always can see both of them exist to certain levels. If you look back on a trial that you handled very well, you could say, well, maybe faith was here, doubt was here. Maybe a trial that you didn't handle so well, vice versa. Let's turn to Mark chapter 9, verse 16. You know, I think it's a misconception sometimes in the church of God to think that someone who is just strong in the faith and just, you know, walk in step with Christ has no doubt whatsoever. Doubt and faith cannot mutually exist. It's either one or it's the other. And I think that that is false, brethren. Let's turn to Mark chapter 9, verse 16. And we'll look at an example of how faith and doubt exist at the same time. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes at the teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him, and when the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" Notice his response. "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." I believe many of us have probably uttered this line throughout our lives. I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief. Unbelief, doubt. How can he doubt? I mean, it's Jesus Christ there in front of him. How can you doubt? You know, doubt is rooted in the physical. It makes its case by what you see, hear, taste, smell, uses the senses, things that you experience. And as I said, what we paid attention to when the father was asked, how long has his son been like this? From childhood. He had been dealing with this for a very, very long time. He was conditioned to think that his son would never get any better. He was conditioned to have no hope. I mean, can you imagine being in his shoes and seeing your son, you know, suicide attempts after suicide attempts, seizure after seizure, just no hope of him getting any better? I believe, but help my unbelief. How about you? Are you able to say the first part of that sentence and leave the last one off? I believe. Are we able to leave off that help my unbelief part? Let's turn to Mark chapter 11 and verse 22. We all have doubt. There's no doubt about it. Some maybe more than others, but doubt is there. Mark chapter 11, verse 22. Have faith in God, Jesus answered. Truly I tell you, if anyone says to this mountain, go and throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in their heart, but believes that what they say will happen, it will be done for them. So can you move a mountain? If you're to stand at the foot of a mountain and you're to pray and you say, get up and go into the sea, will it do it? Do you think that mountain will grow legs and start to walk? I know that phrase seems somewhat silly to us because who's really going to try to move a mountain? But you know, the fact of the matter is God tells us that we can do something and we come up with reasons why we cannot. That is doubt. Now, I'm not saying we all, you know, go home and find a mountain and start praying and put our faith to the test. But in the same sense, we have to realize that doubt is always there. It's always building its case. That mountain's too heavy. It's too big. Why can we not move that mountain? See, doubt is rooted within us. And I would suggest that it's rooted so deep and it is so integral in our physical lives that it will never be eradicated until Christ returns and we are changed. In the same way that father looks at that at his son that's had seizure after seizure, you know, and he just sees that constantly. When someone tells him that kid's going to get better, he's almost got to see it before he believes it. And in that case, sometimes that's the case with us. But that's what God wants us to work on, brethren. It's not, we shouldn't always focus on the physical signs for our faith. Or that should be what we try to work on. Let's turn to John chapter 20. You know, doubt is a scholar. It knows its history. It knows its science. It's educated in the ways of the world. And chief of all, it is a great debater. This is why Christ does not like us focusing on physical signs. John chapter 20, verse 24, we'll read about the famous doubting Thomas. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, was one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, I'm going to have to see some nail marks in somebody's hands before I believe this. I'm going to need to put my hand into his side or you're not going to convince me. I will not believe, he said. A week later, his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. And Thomas says, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So why are they blessed? Because they have not seen and believed. Is it because somehow they're stronger and it, you know, it just takes more faith, or, you know, what? Well, maybe so. Maybe so. Or is it because their faith is grounded in something that cannot be explained or disproved by the physical? See, they are on a stronger footing in their walk with God. If it doesn't require you to see something for you to have faith or for you to believe it, you're in a much stronger situation. See, Thomas would not believe until he put his hand in his side. In other words, lay that mountain flat and then I'll believe. But I need to see that mountain flattened first. And the question we have to ask ourselves is when he moves that mountain, there's going to be another one behind it. How many mountains does he have to lay flat? How many times do we have to see God work things in our lives and miracles in our lives before we finally start to believe? You know, oftentimes when we come in trials and tests in our walk in life, we'll take stories that are applicable to us in the Bible and we'll use them, you know, just like the deliverance of the children of Israel. If we're in a trial, we'll look to that deliverance, right? You know, we'll look to that and say, oh, yeah, he delivered the children of Israel, he'll deliver me. And you'll look at, you know, many examples in the Bible. But, you know, they're not all examples of physical success, I guess you could say. I mean, I was looking at the chart of the disciples the other day. All of them, most of them martyred. I mean, John was exiled, but some of those martyrdoms were gruesome. You know, and when Paul walked on the earth, he faced a lot of persecution and trials. So you can't just take the physical things and say everything physically is going to work out good for me. Because guess what? When it doesn't, where's your faith at? That's why Christ says a wicked and adulterous nation looks for a sign. If you look to signs to validate your beliefs or your stance with God, you are setting yourself up to be swayed by the overwhelming evidence of doubt. You know, the miracle that God is working in our life, the main thing that he's trying to overcome, of course, is the changing of the mind, not the physical. The miracle is a mind that faces tragedy with courage, that faces the evidence of doubt with trust, worry with faith and fear with bravery. The miracle is when the mind replaces the human reasoning with godly wisdom. No matter what you face, you do it with God. No obstacle is too big. No mountain too high. We have to elevate our thinking. God says, my thoughts are so much higher than your thoughts. We have to elevate our thinking. James chapter 1, in verses 6 through 8. He says, but when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all that they do. Unstable in all that they do. You know, that can kind of cut you to the heart right there. Because, I mean, we all have doubt. I mean, if I was to think about this outside of putting this sermon together, I'd say, you know, I never have a prayer answered. So I always have some doubt. I mean, yeah, I can have some faith too, but doubt's always present to some degree. I think it's better understood by saying this. Do not let doubt become the driving force in your life. Don't react necessarily to the evidence that is presented to you by doubt, by your human reasoning. Because if you do, you sink. Doubt can use some compelling evidence to make you very afraid. As I said earlier, the stories in the Bible, I mean, John the Baptist beheaded. Peter, crucified upside down. I mean, look what happened to Christ. When you're in tough situations, doubt will use those stories against you. It will use those stories against you. We have to focus on something higher. Turn to Matthew chapter 14. So we can focus on things that we perceive to be bad, and we can forget the promises that God has made us. And doubt has a case sometimes, brethren. It does have a case. Matthew chapter 14, we'll start reading in verse 25. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. And when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost!" And they cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I, do not be afraid." "Lord, if it is you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." If it is you. So we always think kind of doubt took place later. Peter's putting Christ on the scales when he sees him. He starts in doubt. You know that word "if," this is something I want to speak about later on, but that word "if" is important because it means there's two outcomes here. Peter's saying, if it's you, let me walk on this water and prove to me that it is you. Lay that mountain flat for me. "Come," he said. And Christ says, "I'll prove it." Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. Beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." So Christ proved to him that he was God. He walked on water, did something awesome, miraculous. But when he's looking out on that horizon and turmoil comes, what does he do? He sinks. When you're looking on the horizon for physical evidence, there's always going to be a ghost or something out there that scares you to death, that makes you sink. So Peter says, not only do I want you to let me walk on water, but also I need you to lay those waves flat. Let's smooth those waves out for me. No storm, no wind. Then I'll be good. That "then" never stops coming. Then I'll be good. Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and called him and says, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Why did you doubt? Why do we doubt? Peter saw Christ, asked him if it was Christ, walked on water, did something miraculous, started to sink. You know, it's not hard to see why Peter loses faith. It is from a story standpoint, but if you put yourself there, it's a storm. It's wind. It's something that he is a human being. He cannot handle that situation. He cannot do anything about it. So he takes his eyes off God and he sinks. You know, and oftentimes we talk about the children of Israel and the story of the Exodus, and we say, "Oh man, you know, how could they have doubted God? I can't believe that." You know, they have an ocean in front of them, and they have an army behind them. That is a scary situation to be in. And I found myself in that exact same situation and having the exact same thoughts and doubts in my mind. Why do we doubt? You know, we simply lack the vision sometimes to see past these obstacles, to see past the mountain, to see past the army, past the storms. We cannot see around or over them. We cannot focus on these obstacles, but rather we have to focus on the fact that God is with us. So we talk about why do we doubt, and that's sometimes pretty self-explanatory. But another question is, what do we doubt? And I think when I asked myself this question, it became pretty obvious to me. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 17. What do we doubt? The whole Israelite community, or Exodus chapter 17, verse 1, I'm sorry. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" Okay, so how were they testing him? They were putting him to the test. How were they testing him? "But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses, and they said, 'Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?' Then the Lord cried, Moses cried out to the Lord, 'What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me.' The Lord answered Moses, 'Go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go, and I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and the water will come out of it for the people to drink.' So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massa. Because the Israelites quarreled, and because they tested the Lord, saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?'" How are they testing God? They were testing God by questioning, "Is he with us or is he not?" When I look back in life, you know, it's not a question of, can God deliver me from these circumstances? Can God deliver me from these trials? Is God with me at this point in time in my life? Or have I been such a bad boy that he doesn't want to have anything to do with me? God does not want us to doubt whether or not he is with us. You know, his companionship is not something that we earn. And I know that I've struggled with that. You feel like you have to be good enough to earn his companionship. I heard something recently that I thought was very fascinating. It said, Christ says, "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments." But he did not say, "If you keep my commandments, I will love you." God loves us unconditionally. He loves us from ground zero. When you start to love God, the results of that are that you'll start to keep his commandments, that you'll start to transform into a character that is worthy of his calling. But God loves you, and his companionship is not something that we earn. And see, doubt will have you believing the opposite. Doubt will have you believing that you are not worthy to come to God for your problems. And no, he isn't with you. He ain't with you because you're not good enough. That's what doubt will tell you. But Deuteronomy 31:6 says, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or terrified because of them. For the Lord your God goes with you. He will never leave you. He will never forsake you." He says, "I will never leave you. I will never forsake you." He's a prayer away. Doubt will have you questioning, am I a son of God? Am I called? Do I know the truth? Does this all actually even mean anything? You know, we have to fight doubt with God's promises. As he says, "I'll never leave you, never forsake you." That's a promise. That's what he tells us. "I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you. I'm here with you." Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Start reading in verse 17. You know, God knows that we have doubt. It's not, as I said earlier, even the children of Israel, when they went to the Red Sea, I don't think God was shocked at the fact that they looked at that army and looked at that Red Sea and looked at Moses and said, "Hey, man, we were fine back there alive. We don't need to come out here and die." I don't think God was shocked at that reaction. Deuteronomy 7, verse 17, "You may say to yourselves, 'These nations are stronger than we are. How can we drive them out?'" See, God's saying, this is what you're going to see some things out there that's going to make you doubt, that's going to make you question, you know, are we on the right path here? Are we doing what's right? Or are we kind of coming up against a dead end? But do not be afraid of them. Remember well what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt. You saw with your own eyes the great trials, the signs and wonders, the mighty hand and outstretched arm with which the Lord your God brought you out. The Lord your God will do the same to all the peoples that you now fear. The Lord your God will do the same to all the peoples that you now fear, that you are actively fearing right now. I mean, fear definitely is accompanied with doubt. Doubt starts fear, I would say. There's something you're afraid of. You are unsure of the outcome, and you're probably thinking it's going to be not in your favor. What we must come to see is that the obstacle is irrelevant, whether it's a mountain, whether it's an ocean, whether it's financial problems, whether it's relationship problems, whether it's career problems. The obstacle is irrelevant. We cannot let the trials or the problems of this life make us forget God's promises. And you know, this isn't easy. I think for me, this has been one of the deepest. Actually, I gave this in Raleigh a year ago. And let me tell you, the journey from then to now, this is tough. And it's probably been one of the biggest struggles of my Christian walk, is realizing how prevalent doubt is and sometimes how little amount of faith I actually have. God knows that sometimes you're going to look out on that horizon and you're going to see a formidable foe. You know, to me, it's kind of comforting that he knows that about us, that he knows our temperament, that he knows our personalities, because I think sometimes we don't think that we criticize ourselves by how we react and forget that a loving Father, the way he molds and shapes our lives and the way he moves and puts us in scenarios, just like the children of Israel, he put them in that situation to prove a point to them and to the rest of the world that was watching. He wanted to bring glory for himself against Pharaoh. But that was designed for a purpose. That which you now fear, I will lay waste to it. You will move mountains, and you will walk on water. You will do the impossible. We need verses like this when we see that army on the hill, when we see the boisterous waves. God tells us that he will remove it from our path, or he will give us a way to deal with it. He will give us a way out of it. Maybe not physically, but he will mentally. You know, Stephen faced death looking at the throne of God. Stephen faced probably one of the, not you, Stephen. Stephen got eyes a little big there now. Stephen faced one of the most gruesome things that we'll go through in life. I mean, he was being stoned, he was being killed, and he was comforted by looking at the throne of God. And we can expect that comfort as well. Maybe not being delivered physically, but being delivered spiritually. And I think all of us would agree that that's way more important. Way more important. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, I'll just read it. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. You know, being sound spiritually, staying in today. Because I tell you, I live in tomorrow way more than I should. And you know what's in tomorrow? Worry and doubt. We might as well be in the wilderness of the children of Israel if you're looking into tomorrow. Because there's so many things we cannot control. So many things out of our element. Just like being in the desert and looking on the horizon and trying to guess where your next meal is going to come from. Or, you know, what are we going to do to survive? That's the way looking into tomorrow can be sometimes. God is saying, stay in today. Tomorrow will worry about itself. As a matter of fact, God's in tomorrow. He's there and he's got it taken care of. I remember this was, I guess it would have been about a year ago now, I had a medical thing that was going on that kind of scared me and ended up not being an issue. But I remember calling Dad up, and I'd had a lot of stress at work, a lot of situations that were just really weighing heavily on me. And then I had this thing pop up, and man, I felt defeated. I felt as mentally as bad as I had in a long time. And I remember calling Dad and asking for anointing. And when we walked down there, you know, of course, when you're getting anointed, Dad's, well, you know, what's the problem? And I just remember thinking in my head, is, you know, yeah, I want this medical thing to be all right, but I just want to be at peace with whatever is going on. I want to, you know, it's like being in a taxi with God. I want to sit in that back seat, and I want to trust where he's going and not saying, hey, you sure you don't want to take this turn right here? Or, hey, how about taking this? Can we fix this situation? It's like I'm using God as a genie. Fix this problem in my life. Oh, this thing popped up. God, fix this. And I'm looking to these situations for peace. And I'm going through that instance, I realized, man, these are always going to be here. These situations are always going to come. And I'm always going to feel this way, defeated and beaten. I just want peace of mind. I just want to trust what God is doing in my life. I want to look at that giant, as David did, and say, I am well able to slay this giant. That's what I want to do in life. I think all of us do. We have to transcend that physical stuff. And the more it beats on us and the more it gnaws at us, the easier it is to say, you know what, I'm done with it. Give me what you got, God. You know, there's always going to be waves, winds, giants, armies. What is our faith in, brethren? Is he going to get rid of those giants? Is he going to move them out of our path? Is he going to vanquish the waves, lay them flat for us? Is he going to destroy those armies? You know, it's kind of important to note, too, that through all the instances, if you look back, God gave a lot of signs when it was asked, just like Peter. Hey, God, if it's you, let me walk on water. And God did it. He gave them what they needed, right? But it didn't work. And I think he knew that it wouldn't. God will do what is necessary to build your faith. But the real victory comes when we realize what God is after, what God is building in your life. And that is the confidence, that is the assurance that God is with you. That is what he's building in our life. As we go through life, that's the number one thing that we can realize. Everything else is irrelevant. As I said, Stephen faced death with God, faced one of the most traumatic things. David slayed Goliath. I mean, we could go through tons of Old Testament examples of what was accomplished with great odds against them and what God was able to do. But you know, God's not always just going to make it easy, right? He's not just going to pave the way. As a matter of fact, I'd say sometimes he may do the opposite, but it is for your benefit. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21 and verse 4. They traveled from Mount Hor all along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? All right, here we are again. I mean, I was good with a pot of meat and water and bread. Why are we out here in the wilderness? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food. Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, we sinned, we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us. So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, make a snake, put it on a pole, and anyone who is bitten can look at it and live. So Moses made a bronze snake, put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at it, at the bronze snake, they lived. You know, there, you wouldn't really expect God to fix this situation in the way that he did. I mean, why wouldn't he just let the snakes just call off the snakes? I mean, they learned their lesson, right? Just, you know, let snakes be gone. Why put the snake on a pole and make people look at it? It seems kind of odd if you think about it. But if you think about it in this sense, God took what the Israelites feared. He took what had been biting them, what had been killing them, what had essentially probably wrecked their mental health. And he puts it on a pole and he says, you're going to face this, but you're going to live. You're going to look at what's been causing you turmoil and what's been causing you pain, and you're going to face it. But you're going to live. What's interesting is Christ says, so just like that snake was lifted up in the wilderness, so will I be. Christ compared himself to this scenario, to this instance. He's going to put us in situations where we have to face that which we fear, that which holds us captive. We are going to have to face that. But we have the same hope that the Israelites did, and that we look at Christ. We will look at what we fear, but we will live. One of the number one commands in the Bible is do not doubt, especially do not doubt that I am with you. Have no fear because I have overcome the world. Christ said that, do not fear, I've overcome the world. You know, if we take a look at the Exodus of Israel and we zoom out, kind of take a wide angle approach, I think you can see a profound roadmap of your life. Because they faced tyranny. They were slaves, subjected to harsh treatment for a long period of time. And then they're delivered. They're free. They're going to a land of milk and honey. They're going to inherit all this great stuff. It's kind of like us at baptism, right? We get the truth, and it's like, man, this is all. I just remember feeling so great, you know, at baptism and such a connection. But guess where the Israelites go? The desert. They're not, you know, getting honey out of the pot. They're in the desert. You know, and it's kind of funny. I was talking to Dad the other day, as I said, you know, talking about how we kind of pick on the children of Israel. I'm like, you know, they went without water for like 3 days. I could imagine some of them are going, man, I thought this was going to be a little smoother than this. I mean, I'm thirsty. I would be that way too. So they come, you know, they're delivered from slavery, but they go into the desert. And, you know, this resonates with me so much, especially in my brief history here of what I've been going through as far as I can remember, as far as my trials anyways. I just feel like I was in the wilderness sometimes. You're looking around and going, where am I really going? What am I doing? You know, I think a lot of us can feel that way sometimes. We're in the wilderness. You know, guess where Christ went right before he was tested by Satan? The wilderness. The wilderness does something to us. Something special to the physical body that you probably can't get anywhere else. It highlights a lot of things about us that we have to face. You know, God brings the children of Israel. And as I said earlier, He kind of knew how they were going to react when they would, because he wasn't going to bring them by the land of the Philistines, because guess what? He said, well, if they go that way, they'll see an army and turn back. So he already knew when they got to that Red Sea, he knew how they were going to react. If not, he would have just brought them through the land of the Philistines. If he thought they were just all faithful and on board, he just marched them right through the land of the Philistines. He could have defeated the army. But no, he brings them to the Red Sea, and he puts them in a situation where they cannot go anywhere, and they're hemmed in. And guess what they have to face? They have to face that which was subjecting them, that which they were afraid of, and he brought it to them and did what? Destroyed it in front of their eyes. He didn't have to bring Egypt's army to them to do that. He could have just destroyed Egypt right where it was at. But no, he brings it to the children of Israel, makes them face it, and then destroys it. He will do the same thing with the doubts and the fears in our life. And sometimes we got those doubts and fears, and we feel like, oh boy, you know, I'm doubting, therefore I'm not in lockstep with God. I'm this and I'm that. And sometimes I don't think we realize how relevant some of that stuff is and what God is actually doing behind the scenes. He will bring glory to himself, and he will glorify us one day. And he's doing that actively every day. So when we find ourselves in the desert, don't be afraid to be there. Don't be scared of it. When you're in that wilderness, don't feel like you've done something that's put yourself there and you're there alone and you're there not with God and you were better off where you were. Because that's not the case. You're there because God is taking you somewhere. He's taking you to the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. You know, I heard an old proverb one time. I'm sure many of us have heard it. I think it was like an Indian proverb, if I'm not mistaken, about the two wolves that live within you. One's doubt, one's fear. Whichever one you feed lives. Whichever one you starve dies. We have to feed faith and starve doubt. Let's look upon Christ, brethren, and let's draw close to the Father. You will be healed. You will be delivered. Do not doubt that, brethren, and stand firm on that foundation of faith.